speaker is Governor John Kasich of Ohio. He held his first elective office as a state senator in Ohio. Then he served 18 years in the U.S. House, including chairing the Budget Committee. After a stint in the private sector, he was elected governor of Ohio in 2010 and was reelected in 2014. Governor Kasich, welcome to the relocated soapbox.
Thank you. Do I have to stand up here? Can I stand down here? Can I stand down here so I don't fall off the stage? You know what happened to the leader of the Foo Fighters? He fell off the stage, and I'd rather not do that. Hey, it's great to be with you. I just want to tell you a couple things and some things that I've noticed here at the fair today. Number one, just a little bit about my background and my record, just so you know. I grew up in a little town outside of Pittsburgh called McKees Rocks, and my father was a Democrat all of his life. His father was a coal miner. My mother was a very opinionated and smart woman, but not highly educated because her mother lived with us, could barely speak English. It was a town, folks, where if the wind blew the wrong way, people would find themselves out of work. And I think it's important for people to know that I grew up in a place where people never got the kind of the favored treatment. You know, it was not a place where anything really special, the promotions or those things, it was just hardworking folks. And I got elected to public office without really really even including so much the Republican Party. I ran for office because I thought I could make a difference. I am a Republican, but the party has always been my vehicle and has never been my master. And so I recruited just a lady like you, ma'am, to help me and to go door to door. And so I've been, throughout my entire career, a pretty independent person. I believed in balanced budgets, but I believe in cleaning up waste no matter where it is. I was one of the original fighters against corporate welfare in the Congress, and it was at times a lonely endeavor. I spent 10 years of my life when I was in Washington to balance the federal budget. My first budget that I presented, after a guy challenged me who said, if you don't like what's going on in Washington, what would you like to do about it? I wrote my own budget. And there were votes on four budgets that year, the president's budget, it was a Republican, the Democrat budget, the Black Caucus budget, and the Kasich budget. And the vote on my budget was 405 no and 30 yes. I thought I was doing pretty well, though, because I had 29 other people that thought that it was not right to mortgage our young people's future. And I also thought there's a good value, which is you don't live in debt. And so I spent 10 years of my life fighting for that, literally 10 years. And in the late 90s, I worked with the Clinton administration, and I was one of the chief architects of the first time we balanced the federal budget since man walked on the moon. We paid down the largest amount of the publicly held debt, and the economy was doing very well. I also was a military reformer. When I first went to Congress, the only committee I was on was the Defense Committee, and I found hammers and screwdrivers and wrenches along with a couple other congressmen that cost tens of thousands of dollars. And so I went about in reforming the Pentagon most of my career. People called me and my friends cheap hawks, that we were for a strong America, but we wanted to make sure that we didn't waste money there. When I left Washington after that budget episode, we had a $5 trillion surplus, and I decided to leave. And I went into the private sector, and then I felt the call to go back into public service. And hopefully I can get to this in just a few minutes. So I ran for governor, and the state was in very bad shape. We had lost 350,000 jobs. We were $8 billion in the hole. Our credit was at risk. And four and a half years later, we are now up 350,000 jobs. We're running a $2 billion surplus. We've cut taxes by the most amount of any sitting governor, including tax relief for small businesses, which are the engine of economic growth. And then as we have grown and become stronger, and this is an important thing for me to say to you, we don't believe that anybody should be left in the shadows, that we feel that with more economic progress, people who have mental illness, drug addiction, the working poor, developmentally disabled, the autistic, and our friends in the minority community, that everybody deserves a chance to live out their God-given purpose. We had a re-election, and I was able to receive 26% of the African American vote, 51% of union households, 60% of women, and the second largest electoral victory in modern Ohio history. And it happened for, I think, two reasons. One, hope has come back to Ohio. But the second reason is, I like to think that many, many people in Ohio don't feel as though they're being shut out, that they're being, that they have a chance to get ahead. I think that's what we want in our country. Now, I want to talk to you about something that is, I think, so critically important for me to suggest to you and you to listen to what I want to tell you now. Over the weekend, there were some articles printed about ISIS rounding up 12, 13, and 14-year-old girls and using them as sexual objects and trading them as an object to their fighters. ISIS represents, in my opinion, with the beheadings, the attacks on people of faith, the abuse of women, an attack on Western civilization. Not just a national security threat to us, but something even deeper. People who want to destroy our very way of life. That same weekend, last weekend, I read about two young people who live in Starkville, Mississippi. I've been to Starkville, Mississippi. It's the home of the Mississippi State University. It's a very sweet town. And the story was about a young man and a young woman who were arrested because they were trying to board a plane to make a connection to fly to Syria to join ISIS. Now, let me be clear on the military front. I have said for a long time now that America, as part of a coalition, needs to destroy these people. We need to go, erode them, and destroy them, because we're either going to do it now or it's going to cost us a lot more later. But at the same time I say that, the military effort is only one part of what I believe we all need to think about. Why would this 18 and 19-year-old seemingly normal, two very attractive people wanting to go and join ISIS? Why do we find some of the most successful people that we read about, am I right, young man? And we read about them being attracted. And what ISIS tries to offer is a sense of family, a sense of importance, and a ticket to paradise. They are liars, distorters, and murderers, and rapists. So what about us? What's happening? You know, I think for a while, Western civilization has practiced two fundamental objectives. And Richard Cohen, the New York Times columnist, wrote something about this. Number one, we worship freedom. And I don't mean just freedom to be free, but everybody can do whatever they want to do. And nobody, there's no overarching rules, there's just do whatever you want to do. And I think about my 15-year-old twin daughters. If my wife and I raised our daughters to just do whatever they wanted to do, what do you think would happen? And secondly, in the West, there seems to be an aggressive effort to find happiness. Because we all want to be happy. But I have to suggest to you that we as human beings who represent the Western ethic and the Western tradition, we need to realize that we have a purpose here on earth. Our purpose relates to healing those who live in our world, and I believe that our purpose involves justice in this world. We built a Holocaust memorial on the grounds of our state house so that every day young people, people of all ages, could recognize what happens with man's inhumanity to man. And there is an inscription on one of the walls that says this: if you save one life, if you save one life, you've saved the world. Now, our responsibility, in my opinion, as human beings and somebody that's had a lot of experience and seen a lot of success and so many ways in which we all live together, I believe that all of us have to be a center of justice and a center of healing, and to realize that life is not just about us alone. Life is about us doing something bigger in our lives for someone else. You know, we have the former speaker here, Brent Sechrist. He's a coach. We've got a state senator here who coached in high school. He's now a state senator. Their passion was to show young people the way, wasn't it? It wasn't to win necessarily the football games or the wrestling tournaments. It was to build character. Some people will say, what is that all about? Well, I think there's some fundamental values we need to think about. I outlined them in my inaugural address: personal responsibility. We can't make excuses for why things don't work out. You know, the dog ate my homework, went out in the fifth grade. Secondly, the idea of resilience. You get knocked down and you get yourself back up. I don't know about you, but I'm rooting for Tim Tebow to make the NFL, okay? I'm rooting for him because I love to see the comeback story. Third, empathy. Too much anger in America today, too much division. You know what empathy really is? It's putting yourself in somebody else's shoes and understanding how difficult life can be. I just had a woman the other day tell me that she knows a bunch of young people who committed, they've now grown up, they committed felonies. They don't know where to go. Can't get work. They were young when they made a mistake. I mean, sometimes we can shake our fist, but I think it's rather than shake our fist, we ought to think about how do they get up on their feet, live their God-given purpose? Think about the people that lose their jobs at 51 years of age. Think about young kids who grow up in an environment where they wake up in the morning and they hear gunshots when they go to school. My mother told me that as a young boy, it is a sin, Johnny, not to help people who need help, but it's equally a sin to continue to help people who need to learn how to help themselves. And we can all be part of both ends of that. And then there's the value of teamwork. You want to fix the fence? You want to deal with immigration? You want to balance a budget? You want to deal with entitlements? You want to do any of those things? You got to do it as a team. One party can't do it all. We have to do it as a team, because while we may be Republicans and Democrats and liberals and conservatives, above all, we're Americans. And this is not a game we play in public life. The purpose of it is to give people an opportunity to be lifted. And then there's the issues of family. One of the great appeal that they lay out there to these young people, you can come and be part of something. And I'm not going to apologize for faith. We've run faith too much out of our society. And it's not about the don'ts. In my opinion, it's about the do's. It's about loving your neighbor. Loving people who don't like you. That can be a hard one. Take it from me. It's about so many of the good things. So today I'm walking around this fair. And I see a young man there wearing an Alzheimer's shirt, standing for something, huh? Yeah, we do need to double the NIH budget and begin to do the vital medical research, and it should be a priority of the government. I just visited the No Labels. Two young guys just came scrambling in, and one of these young guys was like, could I take a picture with you, you know? Because I'm here at this booth because I'm going to stand up for No Labels. Or earlier today, walking through, a young man came up to me wearing a One t-shirt. Do you know what One is, the One campaign? Well, I met Bono back in the late 90s, and he said, I think we should help people in Africa who have big debts, who will never be able to pay them back, and help those countries to get on their feet and save lives. No handouts, just a hand up. I met with Bono. I liked his idea. You know, the song he sings, I Still Haven't Found What I'm Looking For, is not a song about his car keys. We worked together in Washington. And then President Bush, after I left, took up the mantle. And because of simple things like vaccinations and mosquito nets and clean water, people on the other side of the globe now have a decent life. And you know what? When a young boy or girl dies in Africa, we all lose a little bit of ourselves. And when we save a young boy or a young girl's life in Africa, the world moves up because we're all connected. So what I want us to think about, in my opinion, what I want us to think about is, what about us? Everybody coming up on the soapbox, you know, you want to run for president, okay? Okay, we need to have a strong leader. It's absolutely vital that we have someone that can set the tone and bring us together. But you don't think, do you, that that's the answer? The answer is in this room. The answer is back in my hometown of McKees Rocks. The answer is from one part of this country to the other, from one ocean to the other, from one border to the other. It's about us. It's about citizenship. It's about believing that we are the glue that holds America together, not somebody else. And government can have its role, and it's important that it has a role. But we can't wait for somebody else to mentor a kid. We can't wait for somebody else to grab one of these young people and say, do not do drugs. It will lead to a life that you will always regret. We can't wait. I just saw a man over here in the booth, 57 years married. His wife died on the 4th of August. I said, what are you here today? He said, well, because I can't stay at home. Got anybody looking after you? Got anybody taking care of you? You see, I think if we can drive home that we all matter, that we all count, that the strength of this country rests upon us and our commitment, young lady, our commitment to making a difference. We're not looking for sainthood. I'm the most flawed person in this room. But I'm doing this election and this campaign for one basic reason. The Lord's been good to me. He's given me some tools. And I have an obligation to use them. And people say, what about these other candidates? What about this guy or that guy? I do want to thank Donald Trump because he got 24 million people to watch the debate. That was good. But you know, why don't we just, as people holding office or running for office, commit ourselves to just doing the right thing as we see it? Realizing that we don't hold the monopoly on truth, that together we can build a stronger country. That's what I'm all about. So if I am elected president, you invite me back here, right here. And I'll tell you what I'm doing, because I never run from my record. I'll come right here, and then I'm going to ask you what you're doing. And if we do it together, we'll have a stronger country and more inspired people. And that's what America is all about. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Governor. And now, Des Moines Register politics reporter Bill Petrosky is going to ask a couple of questions.
Three pork chops today. Bill was counting them. Three pork chops, an ear of corn. Hold on. An ear of corn. Haven't got my ice cream yet. And I lay down on the Posturepedic because my wife's been telling me to get a new mattress, and I sat in the most beautiful chairs over there. So my staff is like, you got to go to this, you got to go to this. I say, I go to the fair, okay? This is not about, anyway.
That was a question I want. That's
am I supposed to hold this?
No,
here?
I am.
Oh, okay.
That was a question we wanted to ask you. Do you always eat like this, or was this just because of the Iowa State Fair?
That was good. You want to say that again?
You don't show it.
Yes, I was on the little. But look, you know, honestly, you know, it's so crazy for all of you. You wonder what it's like. Well, I'll tell you, Sunday night, I flew to Birmingham, Alabama. And I went to church there where four little black girls were killed in a bombing in the 1960s. And the minister of the church showed up, and the history and the struggle was just kind of overwhelming to all of us. And I was there with some of my friends who traveled with me. And there sitting on the credenza was a Bible that was on the altar that day of that explosion. Turn to the 23rd Psalm. That was pretty remarkable. The next morning I got up. And I went to I went to the University of Alabama Sports Center. Now, I graduated from Ohio State University, okay? Now, you talk about, huh? And the governor of Alabama endorsed me for president of the United States. I was like flabbergasted, and I didn't even ask him. He called me up and said he wanted to do it. So then we left there, and we flew to Columbia, South Carolina. And we had meetings in Columbia where I signed to get on the ballot and an interview with the CBS and some other things, some other meetings. And then we got back in the plane and we flew to Myrtle Beach. And we had meetings there. I had about four meetings there, including a forum. And then we flew to Iowa. And then tonight I fly to New Hampshire. Now, if I'm not eating, I ain't functioning, okay? So there's a couple things you need to do when you do this. And because I'm a believer, you got to be awake. I mean, some people want to get 3-4 hours of sleep. I'm not going there, okay? I'm going to be rested because I want to be happy when I do this. So I exercise, I eat, I call friends, I say my prayers, I talk to my wife and my daughters. Well, you'll know how hard it is to get two 15-year-olds on the phone. And so then I had a chance to come here. And it's a great fair. And it's not just a great fair because I'm here, but, you know, Ohio State has a great fair. We had 980,000 people. You're going to have about 1.1 million. And I love it. And it's been great. And I ain't leaving till I get my ice cream, okay?
This is a celebration of agriculture, the Iowa State Fair. What's your vision for agriculture? And would you make any changes in the USDA?
Well, I'm for agriculture. Let's be clear. You know, the interesting thing, we're a big ag state too, okay? It's our largest industry in Ohio. And I listened to Terry Branstad today. You know, you think about agriculture and we think about traditional agriculture, but what we really have to begin to do is to think about what agriculture is going to look like in the next 20 or 25 years. And I have Bob Peterson with me, who's the former head of the Ohio Farm Bureau. And I believe there are so many products that can come from traditional agriculture that can improve the lives of all Americans. And I keep pushing our people to think about that, to use our universities to do the research, to make sure that agriculture and business is closely linked together so that we can spawn new industries out of agriculture. We're lucky in Ohio now. You know, we found natural gas. And one of the great things about that is it's allowing us to become energy independent. So we don't have to kowtow to the Saudis anymore when it comes to conducting our foreign policy. And it's nice to be energy independent. Yeah, you can clap for that because that's a good thing. So we always look at industries and I say, what are the new industries? What can come from it? Back after 9/11, I'm giving you a long answer. Is it okay if I give you a long answer? After 9/11, I was invited down to the Pentagon with former secretaries of defense to talk about the threat against us. And while I was there, I began to realize the people who lived in caves in some ways had a technology advantage over us. And I suggested to Don Rumsfeld that maybe we get some of the best minds in the country to come in. And two of the people that showed up, and they called me back and said, we want to do it. So I took a group in. And two of the guys that I took in there went back to California, and I went back with them. And they showed up for a dinner with their inline skates tied to the top of their Volkswagen. Now they tie their inline skates to the top of a 707, Boeing 707, and their names are Larry Page and Sergey Brin, and they started a little company called Google. We need to look into the future on all of these things, on agriculture, on energy. And you know one other thing we have to do in government? This notion that government can't work, it's baloney. Just treat it like a business. Fix it. You know, I read the other day, and you know this to be true, how dare a city keep Uber out in order to protect the taxi industry? Okay, that's just wrong. What, are you going to stand in the way of progress? So, free Uber, okay?
One more question. You just briefly touched on this, the issue of people having felonies, having difficulty finding work. This is a country that incarcerates about as many people as any place in the world. Should there be changes in the nation's criminal justice system?
Well, let me just tell you a bunch of things about that. First of all, we have reformed our criminal justice system, and I just was meeting with some attorney generals in other states saying that this determinate sentences that just locking everybody up when it isn't even appropriate doesn't make any sense. Secondly, we are reforming all of our systems. Inside our prisons now, where we have a 37% recidivism, with the national recidivism being 47%, we're giving people a chance to work their way out of prison and work in jobs that exist so when they can get out, they can get work. Let me tell you another thing. You know, I've been criticized by some in my party for having expanded Medicaid. Now, I want to talk to you about this. We have 80% of the people in our prisons are involved in substance abuse. 10,000 people in our prisons have mental illness. Now, let me ask you a question. Does anybody here think we ought to lock up somebody who's bipolar and schizophrenic and put them in prison? So we're treating them now in Ohio. We're giving them a way to get on their feet. For the drug addicted, we take this money and we rehab. We brought our substance abuse people right into the prisons, and they work with them, and they release them into the community so they don't come out and meet the drug dealer on the street corner, and the recidivism rate is 10%. That's a miracle. So the fact is it give people a chance. Now, I want to tell you, if you're a drug dealer, a gangbanger, we're going to lock you up for 1,000 years. That's the way it's going to be. But if you want to try to get your life in order, we can give you a chance, and I think that's what we ought to do. And you know, I was with some people the other day. This guy says, well, you know, I'm a conservative. This is guy talking to me. I'm a conservative, but I have a big heart. I said, why don't you change that? Why don't you say it this way? I'm a conservative with a very big heart, because they're not mutually exclusive. So thank you. Can I tell one more story? I want to tell you one last story, and then we got to get going. I want to tell you how I got started in politics, okay? So I tell you about that little town in McKees Rocks, and I left to go to Ohio State. And I was in a dormitory 23 floors high, and I have 15 college roommates. And I was there for a short period of time, and there were things that I wanted to get changed. And my Uncle Emil told me, Johnny, you ever want to change anything, start at the top. So I called the president of the university's office and asked for a meeting. And they wouldn't let me in, but I kept calling. And then they finally let me in. So I went in, and the president of the university was a very impressive guy. He was very tall and deep baritone voice. He had a big office. It was very, very impressive. So I lodged my concerns to him, and then I looked at him, and I said, sir, I've been in school about a month, and I'm undecided. You know, looking at the rugs and the desk, the furniture, your assistant and all this, maybe this is the job for me. What exactly do you do? And so he told me about his fundraising responsibilities. his academic responsibilities, and he said, tomorrow I'm going to fly down to Washington and have a meeting with President Nixon. And I said, well, sir, there are a number of things that I would like to talk to him about also. Could I go with you? And he said, no. And I said, but if I write a letter, would you give it to the president? And he'd never seen me before. He goes, well, I guess I could do that. So I penned out the letter, basically inviting myself to the White House. Sincerely, John Kasich, P.S., if you want to discuss this further, let me know. By the way, did you just notice my tat there? No? So I see this girl with the Iowa hat on. So he carries the letter to Washington. So a couple weeks later, I go down to my mailbox, and there's a letter from the White House, Office of the President. I open it up. I go upstairs to my dorm, and I call home, and my mother answers the phone. And I said, Mom, I'm going to need an airline ticket. The President of the United States would like to have a meeting with me in the Oval Office. And my mother is shouting, honey, pick up the phone. Something's really wrong with Johnny. So I went home over the Christmas break, the end of my first quarter, and my parents finally agreed to buy me an airline ticket. So I fly down to Washington, I go through the gates, and I'm sitting on a little bench right outside the Oval Office. The bench is still there today. And a guy walks up to me and he says, young man, you're going to get 5 minutes alone with the President of the United States. What do you think? Pretty amazing. Yeah, what do you think? Tell you what I'm thinking. New jacket, new shirt, new tie, new pants. I'm not coming out in 5 lousy minutes. I didn't come all this way. So they opened the door. They opened the door, and I walked in, and there's the president, and he greets me, and I greet him, and I sit down at his desk. And the good news is I spent 20 minutes alone with the President of the United States as an 18-year-old first-quarter freshman in college. The bad news is I spent 18 years in Congress, and if you add up all the time I spent in the Oval Office, I peaked out at the age of 18. I'll see you all. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you, Governor.